Beginning of the End, Chapter 70, The Prosperous Reign of David. This chapter is based on 2 Samuel chapter 5, verses 6 to 25, and chapters 6, 7, 9, and 10. A place was selected 20 miles from Hebron as the future capital of the kingdom. It had been called Salem. 800 years before, it had been the home of Melchizedek, priest of the Most High God. It was almost in the center of the country and was protected by hills. On the border between Benjamin and Judah, it was close to Ephraim and easily reached by the other tribes. To secure this location, the Hebrews must drive out a remnant of the Canaanites who held a fortified position on the mountains of Zion and Moriah. This stronghold was called Jebus, and those who lived there, Jebusites. For centuries, no one thought Jebus could be conquered, but it was surrounded and taken under the command of Joab, and as reward he was made commander-in-chief of the armies of Israel. Jebus became the national capital, and its heathen name was changed to Jerusalem. Hiram, king of Tyre, wanted to make an alliance with David, and he helped him to erect a palace at Jerusalem. He sent ambassadors from Tyre, accompanied by architects and workmen and costly material. The increasing strength of Israel, united under David, stirred the hostility of the Philistines, and they again invaded the country, taking up their positions only a short distance from Jerusalem. David withdrew with his men of war to the stronghold of Zion. So David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you deliver them into my hand?" And the Lord said to David, "Go up, for I will doubtless deliver the Philistines into your hand." David attacked at once, defeated them, and took from them the gods that they had brought to ensure victory. Frustrated because of their defeat, the Philistines gathered a larger army and returned to the conflict. Again, David asked the Lord for guidance, and the great I Am took direction of the armies of Israel. God instructed David, "You shall not go up. Come upon them in front of the mulberry trees, and when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the mulberry trees, then you shall advance quickly, for then the Lord will go out before you to strike the camp of the Philistines." If David, like Saul, had chosen his own way, he would not have been successful. But he did as the Lord commanded, and he drove back the army of the Philistines from Gibeon as far as Gezer. Then the fame of David went out into all the lands, and the Lord brought the fear of him upon all nations. 1 Chronicles chapter 14, verses 16 and 17. Ark returned to Jerusalem. Now that David was established on the throne, he turned to accomplish a cherished goal, to bring the Ark of God up to Jerusalem. It was fitting that the capital of the nation should be honored with the Ark, the token of the divine presence. David planned to make the occasion a scene of great rejoicing and impressive display, and the people responded gladly. The high priest and the princes and leading men of the tribes assembled at Kirjath-Jearim. David's spirits were brimming with holy zeal. The ark was brought out from the house of Abinadab and placed on a new cart drawn by oxen, while two of the sons of Abinadab accompanied it. The people of Israel followed with shouts and songs of rejoicing, a multitude of voices joining in melody with the sound of musical instruments. David and the house of Israel played music before the Lord on harps, on stringed instruments, on tambourines, on citrums, and on cymbals. With solemn joy, the vast procession wound its way along the hills and valleys toward the holy city. But when they came to Nacon's threshing floor, Uzzah put out his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen stumbled. Then the anger of the Lord was aroused against Uzzah, and God struck him there for his rashness, King James Version, marginal reading. And he died there by the ark of God. Terror fell on the rejoicing crowd. David was greatly alarmed, and in his heart he questioned the justice of God. Why had that fearful judgment been sent to turn joy into grief and mourning? Feeling that it would be unsafe to have the ark near him, David let it stay where it was. They found a place for it nearby, at the house of Obed-Edom. God requires precise obedience. The fate of Uzzah was a divine judgment for disobeying a very clear command. No one except the priests, the descendants of Aaron, were to touch the ark or even look at it unless it was covered. God's instructions were that the sons of Kohath shall come to bear them, but they shall not touch any holy thing, lest they die. Numbers chapter 4, verse 15. The priests were to cover the ark, and then the Kohathites must lift it by the rods that were placed in rings on each side of the ark. They should bear the ark on their shoulders. Numbers chapter 7, verse 9. There had been an inexcusable disregard of the Lord's directions. David and his people had started doing a sacred work with glad and willing hearts, but they had not done it in keeping with the Lord's directions. The Philistines, who knew nothing of God's law, had placed the ark on a cart when they returned it to Israel. But the Israelites had a plain statement of the will of God in these matters, and their neglect of these instructions was dishonoring to God. Since God's law had been ignored, Uzzah had a lessened sense of its sacredness. With unconfessed sins in his heart, and in the face of the divine prohibition, he had dared to touch the symbol of God's presence. God cannot accept partial obedience or careless ways of treating his commandments. By leading the people to repentance, the death of Uzzah might prevent judgments on thousands. The ark brings blessings to those who love the Lord. Feeling that his own heart was not entirely right with God, and seeing what had happened to Uzzah, David feared the ark, worried that some sin might bring judgments on him. But Obed-Edom welcomed the sacred symbol as the promise of God's favor to people who obey. All Israel watched to see what would happen in his home. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. David was led to realize, as never before, the sacredness of God's law and the necessity of strict obedience. At the end of 3 months, he decided to make another attempt to move the ark, and this time he was very careful to carry out the directions of the Lord. Again, a large crowd gathered around the home of Obed-Edom. With reverent care, the ark was placed on the shoulders of men appointed by God, and with trembling hearts, the vast procession set out. Sacrifices were offered according to David's direction. Rejoicing now took the place of trembling and terror. The king had laid aside his royal robes and dressed himself in a plain linen robe as worn by the priests. This robe was sometimes worn by others besides the priests. In this holy service, David would take his place before God on the same level as his subjects. Jehovah was to be the sole object of reverence. Again, the music of harp and cornet, trumpet and cymbal floated heavenward with the melody of many voices. Then David danced before the Lord, keeping time to the measure of the song. David's dancing in reverent joy before God has been used to justify modern dancing, but in our day, dancing is associated with indiscretion and partying. Morals are sacrificed to pleasure. God is not an object of thought in these places, and prayer would be out of place. Christians are not to go after amusements that weaken love for sacred things. The music and dancing and joyful praise of God when the ark was moved did not have the faintest resemblance to the corrupting influence of modern dancing. One exalted God's holy name, the other is a device of Satan to cause people to forget and dishonor God. The triumphal procession approached the capital. Then a burst of song demanded that the watchers upon the walls throw open the gates of the holy city. Lift up your heads, O you gates, and be lifted up, you everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. A band of singers and players answered, Who is this King of glory? From another company came the response, The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Then hundreds of voices uniting swelled the triumphal chorus, Lift up your heads, O you gates, lift up, you everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. Again was heard, Who is this King of glory? And the voice of the great multitude, like the sound of many waters, was heard in rapturous reply, The Lord of hosts, He is the King of glory. Psalm 24, verses 7 to 10. Then the gates were opened wide, and with reverent awe the ark was placed in the tent prepared for it. As the service ended, the king himself pronounced a blessing on his people. This celebration was the most sacred event yet in the reign of David. As the last beams of the setting sun bathed the tabernacle in holy light, the king's heart was uplifted in gratitude to God that the blessed symbol of his presence was now so near the throne of Israel. But there was someone who saw the scene of rejoicing with a very different spirit. As the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, looked through a window and saw King David leaping and whirling before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. She went out to meet him, and a torrent of bitter words, sharp and cutting, poured from her mouth. How glorious was the king of Israel today, uncovering himself today in the eyes of the maids of his servants, as one of the base fellows shamelessly uncovers himself. David felt that Michal had despised the service of God, and he answered, "It was before the Lord who chose me instead of your father and all his house, to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord, over Israel. Therefore I will play music before the Lord, and I will be even more undignified than this, and will be humble in my own sight. But as for the maidservants of whom you have spoken, by them I will be held in honor." In addition to David's reprimand, the Lord also added rebuke. Because of her pride and arrogance, Michal had no child to the day of her death. Nation freed from idolatry. The moving of the ark had made a lasting impression on the people of Israel, again lighting their love for Jehovah. David tried to deepen these impressions. He made songs a regular part of religious worship, and he composed psalms for the people to sing as they traveled to the annual feasts. The influence of these things resulted in freeing the nation from idolatry. Many of the surrounding peoples came to think favorably of Israel's God, who had done such great things for his people. David had built a palace for himself, and he felt that it was not fitting for the ark of God to be housed in a tent. He determined to build a temple for it, beautiful enough to show how much Israel appreciated the abiding presence of Jehovah their king. When he told the prophet Nathan about his plans, he received the response, "Do all that is in your heart, for the Lord is with you." But that same night the word of the Lord came to Nathan, giving him a message for the king. David was not to have the privilege of building a house for God, but he was given an assurance of God's favor. "The Lord tells you that he will make you a house. I will set up your seed after you. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." God explained the reason David was not to build the temple. "You have shed much blood and have made great wars. You shall not build a house for my name. Behold, a son shall be born to you, who shall be a man of rest, and I will give him rest from all his enemies. His name shall be Solomon, peaceful, for I will give peace and quietness to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name." 1 Chronicles chapter 22, verses 8 to 10. Though the cherished purpose of his heart had been denied, David was grateful for the message. He knew that it would be an honor to his name to perform the work he had planned to do, but he was ready to submit to the will of God. How often those who are no longer as young and strong as they once were cling to the hope of accomplishing some great work that they are not fit to perform. God's providence may declare that they are to prepare the way for someone else to accomplish it. But instead of gratefully submitting to divine direction, many draw back as if offended. If they cannot do the one thing they want to do, they will do nothing. Many try without success to accomplish a work of which they are incapable, while what they might do lies neglected, and because of this the greater work is set back. In his covenant with Jonathan, David had promised that he would show kindness to the house of Saul. Remembering this, the king asked, "Is there still anyone who is left of the house of Saul, that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" He was told of a son of Jonathan, Mephibosheth, who had been lame from childhood. The nurse of this child had let him fall, making him a lifelong cripple. David now invited the young man to come to the palace and gave him the private possessions of Saul for the support of his household. But beyond this, the son of Jonathan was to be the constant guest of the king. Mephibosheth had been led to cherish a strong prejudice against David as one who had no right to the throne. But the monarch's continued kindness won the heart of the young man. Like his father Jonathan, he felt that his interest was one with that of the king, whom God had chosen. After David had been established on the throne of Israel, the nation enjoyed a long period of peace. The surrounding peoples soon decided it would be wise to end open hostilities, and David held back from aggressive war. At last, however, he made war against Israel's old enemies, the Philistines and Moabites, and defeated them. Hostile nations plot against David. Then a vast alliance of surrounding nations formed against David. Out of this came the greatest wars and greatest victories of his reign, and the biggest increases of his power. He had done nothing to provoke this hostile alliance. Here are the circumstances that led to the formation of this alliance. News had come to Jerusalem about the death of Nahash, king of the Ammonites, who had shown kindness to David when he was fleeing from Saul. Wanting to express his appreciation of the favor shown him in his distress, David sent a message of sympathy to Hanan, son of the Ammonite king. Hanan's counselors misinterpreted David's message. They said to Hanan their lord, "Do you think that David really honors your father because he has sent comforters to you? Has David not rather sent his servants to you to search the city, to spy it out, and to overthrow it?" They could not comprehend the generous spirit that inspired David's message. Believing that his counselors were right, Hanan regarded David's messengers as spies and loaded them with scorn and insult. God permitted the Ammonites to carry out the evil purposes of their hearts so that their real character might be clear to David. It was not his will that Israel enter into an alliance with this heathen people. Knowing that David would certainly punish them for this insult to Israel, the Ammonites prepared for war. Those living in the region between the Euphrates River and the Mediterranean Sea joined with the Ammonites to crush Israel. The Hebrews did not wait for the invasion. Under Joab, they advanced toward the Ammonite capital. The united forces of the enemy were overcome in the first battle, but the next year they renewed the war. David, knowing how much depended upon the result of this conflict, went onto the battlefield himself, and by the blessing of God inflicted a defeat so disastrous that the Syrians from Lebanon to the Euphrates not only gave up the war, they also became subject to Israel. The dangers that threatened the nation with destruction proved to be the means by which it rose to greatness. Commemorating his deliverance, David sang, "Blessed be my rock, let the God of my salvation be exalted. It is God who avenges me and subdues the people under me. He delivers me from my enemies." Psalm 18, verses 46 to 48. Throughout the songs of David, the thought was impressed on his people that Jehovah was their strength and deliverer. "Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God." Psalm 20, verse 7. The kingdom of Israel had now reached the full extent of what God had promised to Abraham. "To your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates." Genesis chapter 15, verse 18. Israel had become a mighty nation, respected and feared by surrounding peoples. David commanded, as few sovereigns in any age have been able to command, the affections and allegiance of his people. He had honored God, and God was now honoring him. But danger lurked in the middle of prosperity. In the time of his greatest outward triumph, David was at the greatest risk and met his most humiliating defeat.